I'm Jody, the mom.
And I'm Dr. Barr, the doc.
And this is Mom and Doc Talk, where we talk all things healing pans and pandas.
We bring together the mom experience and the doc expertise to give you the information and tools you need to help make the next right decision to get your child back.
Let's dive in.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to Mom and Doc Talk. Jody and I are so excited to be joined today by Rachel Roberts, who is talking to us all the way from the United Kingdom. So it is morning for me. It is evening for her. We're trying to make sure that our brains are working well enough to meet in the middle. And we're here to talk about research. And this has been a long time coming. Rachel and I have been trying to connect and find a way for her to join us for the podcast to answer all the things about research in general and homeopathy for literally a year and a half now. So I am so, that's just how busy things are in the world of homeopathy research and sharing the amazing research that's going on with the world itself. So let me just take a minute to introduce her really quickly. So Rachel is a first class honors degree in biological sciences, specializing in physiology from the University of Birmingham. She graduated from the College of Homeopathy, London, in 1997 and was in private practice as a homeopath until 2012. Rachel has lectured in homeopathy and medical sciences at various colleges in the UK and overseas. She held the post research consultant for the Society of Homeopaths from 2008 to 2012 and was awarded an honorary fellowship in 2013 to acknowledge her outstanding contribution to homeopathy. Rachel joined the HRI, so the Homeopathic Research Institute, part-time in 2010 and has worked for the Institute on a full-time basis since 2012. In 2018, Rachel was awarded an honorary fellowship by the Faculty of Homeopathy for her highly regarded work in the field of homeopathic research. So welcome, Rachel. We're very honored and excited to have you here with us today.
Thank you so much. So lovely to be here at last.
So I obviously just read your bio, but tell us a little bit more about yourself, like the juicy details about how you ended up.
I was thinking we need to make that shorter. I hate listening to stuff.
Yes, I hate the bios too. It's like, hi, I'm Jen.
Yeah, here, I'm just me. Yeah.
Tell us the juicy details about yourself and how you ended up in homeopathy research.
I guess you sort of get from that I think of myself as a scientist first and foremost. I am a biologist. That's what I think of myself as first. That was my first love. That's what I did at university, clearly. And I really was somebody who thought homeopathy was rubbish, if I'm completely honest.
Same.
Yeah, a bit embarrassing now. So when I was in my early 20s, still at university, I was about to do a PhD in neuroscience. That was what I loved. I was specializing in ears and looking at why kids go deaf after meningitis sometimes, that kind of stuff. It's fascinating to me. Loved it. Just thought I'd spend my life in the labs. And then it was just this whole combination of different separate things that happened to me that completely changed the direction I went in. And I basically went from what you'd now call a homeopathy skeptic or an anti-homeopathy person to someone who got curious. And then I got curious enough to study it. And then once I studied it and realized it actually worked, which really was a bit of a head spin for me, I must admit, then I just couldn't go back. I just found it more and more fascinating the more I learned.
You know, I have been called by somebody in the last like year or so, a modern day Constantine Herring, because I almost quit naturopathic medical school because homeopathy was a required part of the curriculum.
Right.
But you are far more a modern day Constantine Herring, because the way he came to it was through research too. And he actually like was researching it to try and disprove it and then accidentally found out, oh, nope, it works. And then became one of the biggest promoters and founded the Hahnemann School of Homeopathy here in the United States, which became Hahnemann Medical College, now part of Drexel. So anyway, a whole big, like a medical school that still exists that was founded by somebody who went out to disprove homeopathy and instead found that it was the most powerful medicine. So
absolutely. And I do try to never let go of that person I was at 21, because it helps me communicate now with the people who are still in that mindset, who still just go, it's not possible, or it can't be, or whatever, like this brick wall feeling. And I do remember that. But what I have to try to say to them as nicely as I can without being combative is, if I remember how I was then, I knew nothing about homeopathy. When I was speaking against it, if I was ever asked, I mean, I wasn't going out of my way to say anything, but if someone said homeopathy, I'd just laugh and say, don't they understand science? Don't they understand Avogadro's constant? You know what I mean? But I knew nothing. And that's what you won't find.
Right. with homeopathy is if we're saying, is this really doing something? Is this really making a difference?
I've never stopped asking that question, and all that. I don't practice anymore, obviously, but I did practice for 12 years. Now I just do it for free for people I know. Do you know what I mean? So that's the big difference. I don't still get paid anymore. But I do remember, even when I was practicing, I think every homeopath knows this. There are lots of cases where better, and you can never say for sure how much was the pill, how much was the lifestyle advice, how much was the consultation where people learn about their own health for the first time. It's hugely beneficial. So it's a whole package of care you're giving. But then there are those cases where you know damn well it was the pill. It was a baby, or it was a child who didn't even know they were given something, or whatever, Or my favorite were the husbands of my patients who got sent. And they were not willing. It's like, I've only come because my wife keeps nagging me, and they almost don't want it to work. Do you know what I mean? It's quite funny. It's like, well, I don't think it's going to work. You're like, that's fine. You don't have to believe in it. Do you know what I mean? Just take the pills, So when they do well and they come back kind of poleaxed by it, like there's a mixed feeling of, well, I'm glad I'm better, but I'm totally confused now because I really didn't think it was going to work. And I used to found that those cases were the most rewarding in some
Oh,
way.
for sure. For sure. And as we said, there's sometimes where we don't always know for sure. And that's why I'm so grateful there's someone like you and all the people that you work with who are doing the research so that I don't have to, because that's just not
The
where
only
my
way we
brain.
can know for sure.
That's where my brain goes, but that's where you can say, look, there is research behind it and here's where it is. So that's why I'm so grateful.
I feel like there are a whole lot of moms that were just like, that's my husband. They're talking about my husband. I appreciate that you share your skepticism because I think many of us PANS moms, as we're navigating getting help for our kids, have this skepticism about homeopathy, and it's just really hard. So it's so beneficial to hear stuff from you, someone who knows it, who's doing it, and all of that. And also too that you're skeptic of it and you remain a bit of a skeptic, even though you know. So I know you get asked this all the time, but is there any evidence that homeopathy works?
Yes. Can I say that again? Yes. Yes. It's so frustrating. I feel like I've been saying this for about 15 years now, and it's still true. We do have clinical trials done exactly the same way you do them on conventional medicine. We have those same studies for homeopathy. So we have 330 clinical trials where you took at least two groups of people and gave one group homeopathy and the other group something else to compare it against, whether that's placebo or another treatment or usual care or something. So that's 330 clinical trials published in the peer-reviewed journals. This is real science and real data. So if anyone ever says there's no evidence, completely wrong. If anyone ever says there's something wrong with it, absolutely not. This is just the same as normal research. So that's kind of the biggest message I have. We have it and it's pretty normal.
So, what does the research show in terms of the placebo effect in homeopathy? Because that's
Well,
one
what
of
we
the biggest
see,
things.
yeah, absolutely. Inside those, that just those clinical trials in humans, that's just that data set, you've got individual examples of high quality studies that have tested it specifically against placebo, because people always want to know about that, in these double blind randomized controlled trials, DBRCT. So this is like the gold standard drug trial that you'd expect. And when you compare homeopathy against placebo in those kind of high quality studies, you do see that it works. We have these examples. So there's examples showing it works for sinusitis, tonsillitis, hay fever, hormonal conditions like PMS, menopause, depression, things like this. So, yeah, that's what people don't seem to be able to hear or don't know about, that we do have those great examples. But what I get asked a lot is, well, is that enough to say it's not placebo? And I would have to say myself, no, it's not. For me, I would need to see a lot more of those to just believe it from the clinical data. For me, what tipped me over the edge, if you like, for sure, was that we don't just have trials in humans. We have research done in plants, in animals, in cells. We have research done all over the world. So HRI holds conferences every 2 years. The 60 or so researchers who come every 2 years, these are professors, PhDs, medical doctors, to share their research, are coming from 17, 18 countries. That's typical for us. And they're all getting the same kind of results, right? And some of them, if we think about the plant experiments, we have this amazing new area called agrohomeopathy that has really exploded in the last few years. We kind of launched it on our platforms in 2019 and it's grown ever since. So this is literally homeopathic medicines being used in farming, as you'd expect from the word agrohomeopathy. So we have the scientists doing these experiments, testing them on crops, in fish farms, etc., against placebo. They literally still give placebos, would you believe it? Just to be absolutely belts and braces and make sure there's no way this can be a placebo effect. So when I'm sitting there listening to Antonio from Mexico with seeing results in fish farms, and then the next thing is a study from Ecuador on turnips, and then it's strawberry crops in Brazil. And you see all of this data from all these different researchers in all these different countries. How can that be a placebo effect? It just can't. So for me, I had to see that. I had to see, yes, the clinical data in humans tested against placebo. Oh, good, tick the box. But I also needed to see it in a way that cannot be placebo. And that's the plant experiments, the cell experiments in laboratories, and so on for me.
So we have seen some experiments that show homeopathy, like the nanoparticles formed at the lower potencies that bind at the cellular level and lead to cellular adaptive change. And there's cells and plants. And that's the thing that like I always get my brain gets stuck on. I'm like, plants, really? But I'm like, oh yeah, duh, plants have they're biological
Organisms, exactly.
organisms, exactly. They have cells that have to work and grow and replicate and all the things. So it's different than humans and it's different than animals, but it's still something happening on the cellular level.
Absolutely. I think it's important just to say, like, when people say, well, why should sometimes people are so kind of you get into it. So, well, why would I care if it works on a plant? Well, I think you should care if it works on a plant because the big question here is whether you're only thinking you're getting better because you took a pill and believed you get better. The plants, you
Plants
give
aren't
a
going
remedy,
away.
you get better when you're a plant. That's pretty much proof to me.
Exactly. And the thing that's always just so interesting to me is that it's almost like just accepted that if a medication is available, that it's better than placebo. And yes, they do have to go through rigorous trials to be proven to be better than placebo before they get approved. And yet, there is a whole phenomenon where they do placebo washouts in these trials where they remove people who are high placebo responders, which would make it so many of the things that are barely beyond placebo
Yeah, there
would
is a
not
lot of
actually be.
shenanigans in the research world. And that's again, any criticism you'd make of homeopathy research, people love to try and find fault, right? So, okay, if you, and that's kind of a shift we've seen. To be honest, the people who are heavily engaged in the debate around homeopathy, like the heavyweight scientists who are battling it out, we have seen a shift in recent years. So, for the first 10 years at HRI, it really was you have nothing. And we had to say every day, year in, year out, yes, we do, yes, we do, yes, we do. And interestingly to me, about 2022, there was this shift. So now they've had to accept we have the data. Like, at least we'll take that as a win. They can't ignore it anymore. Now they're saying, oh, there's something wrong with it. It's like, okay, right, next phase. No, there isn't. So anything you might say is, there's strengths and weaknesses to our evidence base, like there is for every evidence base, like there is for conventional medicine. Do you know what I mean? So we only have the same strengths and weaknesses. And I found a really interesting paper not long ago that really shocked me, actually, where it said that 95% of conventional medical treatments do not have high quality evidence to show they work. 95%. I knew it like that a lot of them didn't, or I might have thought maybe most of them, but 95%, I was shocked. So I think we have to get across to people that things are just not as black and white as they think. A lot of people think, well, conventional medicines are tested and we know, and alternative medicines or complementary medicines or natural medicines, whatever you want to call them, are not tested and we don't know. And it is completely not like that. It is much more of a gray area for everybody, I would say. I would say that research is all about taking it one step in front of another and just exploring, but it's not as clear-cut as people think.
That's absolutely true. And speaking of things that are also not as clear-cut as people think, mechanism of action. This is something that comes up so frequently, and it was a sticking point for me. And occasionally it still is. And I've just learned to accept that it's just
Yeah,
something
I'd
I
love
don't
to
fully understand
know.
yet. And I'm very interested and very curious about the research about it. So before we dive into the research about that, which I'd love to hear what you have to share, especially if there's been any updates in the last 2 years since I last saw presentations on this, I need to remind people that a lot of people are like, but how does this work? How can it possibly work? And I need to remind people that we use things like Tylenol, or as you would say, acetaminophen. We do not know how it works, and we use it all the time. And by the way, a lot more people die from overdoses on acetaminophen than have ever, no, you know, died from homeopathic remedies, right? Lithium is another medication that is frequently used, and it is not available over the counter, but we also don't know how it works. Those are just two like regular examples of things that have a lot more impacts on the body when they're used, but we still don't know how they work. That said, there is some research, as I understand it, into how homeopathy works, and we're getting more and more along the lines of understanding that. So, what can you share with us about the mechanism of action research?
Sure. I mean, I'm really glad you made that point, first of all. I often talk about aspirin. We had aspirin since the 1940s. We later found out it's an anti-prostaglandin, but that was decades later. And apparently they're still finding out what aspirin does today. So, we should not need this in order to use it, is the first thing. However, as a scientist, I cannot wait until they figure this out because I'm dying to know myself. There are lots of people working on it around the world. Alex Tournier, who is the founding chairman of HRI, has just this minute, a few months ago, published a scoping review he's been working on for the last few years. And this is a really important step forward because what he did was looked systematically at every single publication on this to date, ever. So it's about 219 publications, and looked to see what the main theories are. And he found 14 completely distinct frameworks, if you like, theories and hypotheses around mechanism action of homeopathy that are being pursued. And that was an important step because until you do that, until you get that oversight of the entire story, you can't really progress. So now that can be the foundations for all the next steps for everybody. Everyone can go, okay, we know this, we know that, we don't know this yet, we should pursue this avenue of inquiry. As you said, nanoparticles is a popular one. There's also several that are around quantum effects, some that are around water structures, some that are a combination of all of them, or some people think it might be one thing at the lower dilutions, then cross over into other mechanisms as we go to higher levels of dilution. So there's a lot of work in progress. And the thing I was thinking I find again most interesting as a step forward is there's certain scientists, you might have heard of Stephen Cartwright, who we've funded from day one. There are people who are deliberately taking a specific approach. They are basically looking more at the characteristics of these remedies and these medicines. So basically, what can they do? What are they sensitive to? Just like really basic research. And in particular, another way of doing it is you look at what kills the signal. So to give you an example that's quite recent, there's a researcher based in Switzerland called Paul Duisberg who's presented at our conferences, and he did a very simple plant experiment where he took stannum 30x made of tin, and he treated these cress seedlings, so just the cress you'd have in your egg and cress sandwich, and used that remedy to see if you could see an impact on the germination rate and the shoot length of these seedlings. And he could. So the homeopathic remedy changed the germination rate and it changed the shoot length. Not supposed to happen. So that's already showing that the medicine does something. But then he exposed it to mobile phone radiation to see if it would damage it. And it did. 14 hours exposure to a continued voice call killed the homeopathic medicine and it wouldn't work after that. So he repeated the experiment and it didn't work anymore after that exposure to the microwave radiation. And that was a result that he saw across 20 experiments done by two independent research teams. So we can show it affects the plants, then we can kill it. So for a lot of scientists, what destroys something is the best way to understand it. So that tells us that homeopathic medicines are sensitive to microwave radiation. So that tells people other than me, I am not a physicist, that gives them clues. Do you know what I mean? So there's a lot of experience like that. Can they withstand heat? Can they withstand certain types of electrical current? Can they withstand like all these kind of things they're testing them with to learn more about the characteristics of the medicines?
That's really, really interesting. So it was the remedy itself, the homeopathic medicine that was exposed to the 14-hour
They
voice
literally
call.
proved that it worked first, then exposed it to the phone for 14 hours, then tried it again, and it all stopped,
Yeah.
which is why I do not keep remedies anywhere near my mobile phone.
Same. And that's why we tell people store things away from Wi-Fi, phones, microwaves, anything that's like emitting a pretty strong electric field that could interfere. Absolutely.
Absolutely. So yeah, it's work in progress, and I think the other big step forward, I think, is in understanding. So we've learned a lot over 30 years from Stefan Baumgartner's work in Switzerland. He's the expert with plants. Is that we know that these experiments you do in labs work better if the system you're using, whether it's a plant or a cell or whatever, is ill, if it's diseased, if it's stressed, they call it. And that's because that mimics homeopathy in the real world, right? You're not giving homeopathic medicines to healthy people, you're giving them to sick people. And because it is like treats like, you need those symptoms, if you like, to treat. So it might sound obvious to us that that makes sense, but for a lot of these researchers years ago, they didn't care about that. They were playing around with plants and cells in all sorts of conditions. He was able to show over his 30 years of work as a physicist, no, you need to make them sick first and then expose them to a homeopathic medicine in the lab, and that's when you get the results.
That makes so much sense because, homeopathy is not something that you can use like you could a supplement where you try to like super dose and like force the biochemistry. Homeopathy is never going to force your biochemistry. It's going to nudge your body to restore its appropriate biochemical state.
Absolutely.
So
I'm
you
trying to
can't.
explain to people, like, the way I say it is that it's like a lock and key. So if you imagine the remedy is a key, if there's no lock to put it into, you're bashing against a wall, right? Just
Yeah.
does nothing. Somebody's sick, you have that little hole you can put your key into. And then if it's the right remedy, it turns. If it's the wrong
Yeah.
remedy, you can go in, but nothing happens. If it's the
Yeah.
right remedy, the lock turns in the key
We use a
turns.
lot of analogies of like hiking and climbing mountains and everything. And the remedy is a nudge. And if you're already going in the right direction, you're already moving. You don't need the nudge. And if you get nudged, but it's a minimal nudge, you're not going to feel it. Whereas if you're like sitting down or like laying down at the bottom of the mountain, you're going to feel the nudge that is getting you going because it's changing your state.
Lovely, lovely. I think another analogy that came to me at some point was I was having a quite frustrating conversation with a scientist who was really, like, I call the brick wall, and he was saying, well, if homeopathy works, I've got to throw out everything I know about physics and chemistry and biochemistry. I was like, no, don't freak out. You don't have to. I know that feeling because I remember that, but you don't actually. And we were drinking wine, so it got a bit creative. I remember thinking it's like my car happens to be of the era where my single key is an actual physical key, right? There is a lock and I put the key in, turn it, but it also has a clicker. I don't know why it has both. And that's how I see it. I see it's as well as, all our biochemical drugs will still work. That's fine. You want to take them, why not? That's fine. Homeopathy to me is just another toolkit, as well as. It's not instead of, it's not necessarily better or worse, it's just another toolkit. I can have a key and a clicker. And once he said that, I said, you don't have to throw everything away. It's not that dramatic.
Right. It's an add-on. And it's like to me, it's like the things we know about physics and chemistry and everything and biology right now is the starting point. And there's this thing that we can see it, like we can see using the scientific method, we can see the impacts that it has. And we will continue to do the work to explain why and how it happens.
Absolutely. But if anyone says to me it's impossible, meaning because sometimes we use dilutions that have gone so high there shouldn't be any molecules there, they say it's impossible. I understand that emotionally, but scientifically, it's not a great argument when you can see it in plant experiments and when you see it change the activity of a cell. You can't say that's impossible if you just saw it. It's not an argument. Do you know what I mean? So I think it's about that. Trying to stay non-emotional about it and just trying to look at the data and say, what's this data telling me? If I forget the word homeopathy, if I just look at this study, what does it say? And the study says it works. And that's as simple as the science gets in some ways.
So I'm going to bring this up just because it's what you're talking about right now is the concept of plausibility bias. So,
Yeah.
can you tell us a little bit about how this concept of, again, plausibility bias, where basically it's, is this even plausible, or is this is not even plausible, how that impacts the understanding of homeopathy research?
Sure. So people are more familiar sometimes with confirmation bias, which is basically we all have this, whether we like it or not, or like to admit it or not, that if something comes out, a piece of research that confirms what we already think, we go, oh, yes, that piece of science must be very good because it's confirmed what I think I already know. So that is confirmation bias, and it's very, very common. It's quite hard to get out of that cycle. Plausibility bias is almost the opposite of that. It's where it does not matter how good the data is, someone refuses to accept it. Basically, they can look at some science, they can see everything is done correctly, it's high quality, the result is positive, but because it's something they don't believe in, they just flatly refuse to accept it and are basically drawing conclusions that are not based on the data. And this is where homeopathy has kind of been trapped for the 15 years that I've been involved in this. And the way, again, I think of it as a brick wall, literally, with the opponents on one side and people like me on the other, where we are looking at exactly the same data set and we're saying, guys, hello. Clearly, this is not placebo. Clearly, there's something real here. Clearly, these medicines have biological effects. We need to do more. They're saying, no, there must be something wrong with it, literally. So I've sat with a professor in who shall be nameless, very important European professor in about 2017, I think it was, showed him one of our best studies, talked him through it, showed him the paper, went through it, was like, there, that shows it's not placebo. And he just said, there must be something wrong with it. We're like, there isn't. We know Robert Mathey personally. We know this data. We know it is what it says it is. There's the paper. No. So this is what it's like. And that's when it feels like banging your head against a brick wall. So I think the only way we can deal with plausibility bias is education. It is also understanding of that frustrate that feeling people have of it's just too much to comprehend, like they can't go there, you know. And when I think about how we ultimately get past it, this is why HRI supports more clinical research and more mode of action research, because the way I see it, clinical research is like building a ladder over the wall. It takes a lot longer, but we will get there eventually. If we keep doing it, we get enough data that it's compelling and you go over the top. But if we find out how it works, boom, straight through the wall, because that's where most people have a problem. So the only way is to do both and see which gets there first.
Ladders and wrecking balls.
Yep, that's the plan.
So you started to touch on this a little bit earlier, but I want you to go a little deeper and explain to us what the challenges are with homeopathy research.
Sure. Probably the most obvious are two things, really. The first is that it's what they call a complex intervention, meaning that we know the benefits come from two things combined. It is the therapeutic effects of the consultation. That's real. It should be if you're good.
Oh, yeah.
You should be leading people to new knowledge and awareness that changes their behavior, changes the way they live, everything, right? That's huge. But also, it's the pills. And if you're good, the pills are a good match and you get a good result. So as soon as you have that complexity of two things working synergistically, actually, I don't believe they're even two separate things. I believe, you know, if you're good, they all come together and give you those great results. That's a challenge for research because you can capture that. People say you can't study homeopathy in clinical trials. That's rubbish. You can. You absolutely can. The methodology's come on a lot over decades, and now we can do that. The way you do that is called a pragmatic RCT for those who care. But basically, what you do is you can still randomize people into two groups. You can then give them, for example, one group gets full individualized homeopathy, consultation, the pill, and everything, and the other group gets usual care, conventional medicine, right? That's fine. The problem is, so the challenge is that that is the best study design. You will capture the full impact of homeopathy, but you can't blind it. You will know what treatment they got. So for some people, I say, oh, no, that's not good enough because it wasn't blinded. But you can't blind that study. You know what I mean? It's the way it has to be done. So on the other hand, the study design where you can really, really test it with the double blind, you don't know what patient got what treatment and all of this, it's considered the highest level. But that will cancel out all of the consultation effects. The way those trials are done, they can be done and we do them, that's great. When you do that, you are isolating out only the effect of the pill. And that's a really interesting question. But it means that when you get a positive result, which we have, something like the PMS study I'm thinking of, brilliant, double blind, randomized, clinical trial, homeopathy against placebo. That result that we saw in the women treated with homeopathy was great, but it wouldn't have been the full effect in reality because we deliberately took out all the benefits of the consultation on purpose so we could still see what the pills did. So can you see, like, whatever trial design you pick, there's pluses and minuses. There's no best study. It depends what you're looking at. So it's impossible to capture the full effects of homeopathy and keep the critics happy by making it ultra rigorous at the same time. You can't do it. So that's the first, is this sort of complexity thing. And the second is the individualization. So drug trials are very easy because in a drug trial, you give everybody the same pill in the same dosage, the same way. It's all the same. That's very easy. And in some types of homeopathy, you can do that. Over-the-counter medicines, for example, you can do that. But homeopathy as practiced by most practitioners is individualized homeopathy, literally tailor-made prescriptions bespoke to every patient. And that's what I love. And that's where you really see the big results. So if you want to test that in research, you can, and we do. But then the critics will say, oh, but you can't replicate it. And replicability is a big thing in research. Technically speaking, you can't make a huge claim unless you can go away and do that trial again and someone else can do it and check it worked. So you can repeat the study, but the prescriptions themselves will be different, obviously, because it's individualized. So we have this conundrum. The good news is that this is not something that's only homeopathy. This is a complementary medicine, TCIM, traditional medicine thing, right? The complexity and the individualization. So there are academics working on this at the WHO. Literally, the last few years, I'm waiting for that study to come out where they have been given the job of saying, go and figure this out. What are we going to say is the best way to test these complex, individualized treatments in a way that the world will accept? So I wish they'd hurry up with that one. Because when that comes out, it's going to be really interesting to see what they decide is the best study design. And what we're hoping is, they may come back and say for homeopathy, it's the pragmatic RCTs I already described. Maybe that's what they'll say. But if the WHO says that, then hopefully people will stop criticizing them when they do them. Do you see what I mean? It's not, I don't think they'll come up with something new. I think they will just legitimize what we're already doing.
I had
Does
a
that
couple of,
help? I don't know. Does that make any sense?
no, I mean, it made sense to me. I had a couple of thoughts that came up that I just have to share. One's a thought, and then one's like a simplistic comment too about a challenge with homeopathy and research. So one of the things that is interesting to me, as you were talking about the like the was it the PMS study that showed the impacts of the pills, but not the therapeutic relationship. And all I can think about is, oh, guys, you got to stay away from the AI. And like, one, we're actually showing there's been a study done recently, and I don't know if you've I'm not going to spring this on you and ask for your comment, but there has been a study done recently with a group here in the United States where they put some cases that had been seen a clinician into AI to with everything scrubbed, and so it was completely nobody, no, de-identified basically. So none of that information to see what the AI would come up with as far as remedy selection. And it was only 17% that actually came up with the remedy that led to resolution of the concerns for the patient. And it was only like 54% even had the remedy in one of their considerations.
Wow,
And so it
interesting.
was really not great for selecting the remedy that led to resolution. So on its own, not great, but then you also miss that benefit of having the therapeutic relationship of somebody understanding what you're going through and guiding you in a way that is nuanced, that you're just not going to get with an
Absolutely.
interaction with AI.
I mean, really good study to be doing. Like, we need to look at that because, like you said, AI is not going away. It's going to be there. So, figuring out its place in homeopathy, I think, is really, really important. And understanding where it can help and not freak people out, where you maintain all the advantages of the human prescriber and it helps you, to me, is a very, very different thing from doing it instead of, you know what I mean? And actually, the PMS study that I was thinking of in particular is a quite interesting study design that I think is going to happen more, which is what they called a symptom cluster approach. So it's basically a halfway house between trying to satisfy, to me, proper individualized prescribing and the issue of being able to replicate a study. So it's quite clever, really. What they did was they said, we are going to do proper individualized prescribing, but it has to be one of 14 remedies. Now, that may not sound very many, but most of us know that actually, in reality, for something like PMS, a lot of people will match one of the top 14 remedies. And the crucial thing is, when a patient came into this study, it was done in a gynecology department in an Israeli hospital. They were obviously interviewed for the study, and as long as they genuinely matched one of those 14 remedies, they went into the study. But if they didn't, they were out. So that's where you are maintaining the integrity of the homeopathic prescribing. If they didn't fit, they're out. Go and get treated normally by one of the other couple of thousand of remedies, right? But if they happened to be their sepia or pulsatilla or whatever it was, they went into the study. So this is a really good way that we can balance those two factors, because they did use a questionnaire to see. You can build a questionnaire built by homeopaths to lead you to one of those 14. And then they gave them the right remedy, but they also had a homeopath double checking and talking. So we're literally trying to keep an eye on this. And they got results. So the beauty of that is that you can replicate that study. You can use the same questionnaire, you can use the same 14 studies, you can do it again, and it is real homeopathy. So that's a kind of balance in between that we're quite keen on promoting.
Yeah, it's just really ultra complicated. And the other, like the not so complicated problem or challenge that I'm familiar with homeopathy research is funding. And because, you can't patent these homeopathic remedies. They're not patentable, so there's not a but like big drug companies who are funneling a whole bunch of money in it because they're getting money from investors and all of that. So
Absolutely. I've had that same thing where it's the first time friends of mine who are in business finally understood our challenge. When they say, why don't you, I'm sure you've got venture capitalists who, if you really had something here, Rachel, you'd have the angels over your shoulder, wanting to pursue. I was like, no. Do you can't patent them because they're in the public domain? I went, oh. It was like, okay, you have a real problem. I said, that's our sector's real problem. It's the money. At the end of the day, it comes down to money. So yeah, either it's the double whammy of, you can't, if it's a couple of million to do a basic trial, then obviously that's easy to get back if you can patent it and make your billions probably. If you can't do that, asking for a couple of million up front for a trial that's just for the greater good is a lot harder to come by. And then the other side of it is, I think the only bit that makes me a little bit angry at times is this debate. It's not just intellectual. This debate we've been having for the last 15 years that I've been involved is real, has real world impact. So when people constantly say, inaccurately, there's no evidence it works, or we know it doesn't work, or the science says it's placebo, all of these things that are completely wrong, that gets into the ears of people who make big decisions. It's in the ear of the main funding bodies, it's in the ear of governments, and so on. So you cannot really get investment in the new studies we need. It's a bit of a catch-22 because they've been told there's nothing here to look at, like it's already game over, and that false information has, that's really held us back as a sector for all these years. That's why I was quite keen to see the shift in 2022. I was like, okay, now I'll roll my sleeves up. We can argue about what's good and bad about evidence, fine. But at least now you're admitting it's there and we have something to build on, because now that will really change the conversation. So hopefully we can start to get the kind of investment that's needed.
How do we overcome these challenges with homeopathy research?
I think it really is so boringly education again. I think it is about challenging people in a nice way. Do you know what I mean? Nobody wants to spend their days arguing about homeopathy. But I think, to me, if someone, the next time someone says, oh, this is rubbish, or it's impossible, or it doesn't work, or whatever, I would like to empower people to challenge that and say, really, where are you getting that from? Just to ask that question. What are you basing that on? Where have you read that? Just ask them. Because often I think people don't even know where they've got it from. It's almost subliminal. And then I would ask them to say, have you seen the HRI website? Have you looked at this website? Have you read this evidence summary? Look, there's the studies, just to start to get that, challenge that mindset.
I just keep going back to what you just said about like the real world impacts and the ways that it's affecting people who are making laws and providing funding and, changing access to things, right? And I think about the community that we serve with PANS and PANDAS, where there is just they're the canaries in the coal mine. I haven't said that in a long time, but I used to talk about this nearly a decade ago about how the kids with PANS and PANDAS are canaries in the coal mine. They're the kids who are sensitive to the things that are not good for us as a whole. They are the ones who are having the reactions to the bacteria and the mold and the chemicals that are like increasing their toxicity toward us, right? They're increasing their pathogenicity toward us. And they're the ones who are the things that they've got available outside of homeopathy are progressively failing for. And the things that worked a decade ago are not working as well as they at work today. And homeopathy is the only consistency that does work and that has stood the test of time for 200 years. I mean, when I go back and I reread some of Hahnemann's writings and like Organon and chronic diseases, I'm like, oh, he was talking about a kid with PANS. And like, there's a couple of cases that I'm just like, he saw PANS back then. And he like, this is what he's talking about. So over 200 years that it's been working. And so it's really disheartening the when we see that the impact of research and the beliefs related to things that are where people are being caught up with their beliefs rather than what they're seeing in front of them is potentially limiting life-saving medicines for people that have
Absolutely.
nothing else available to them. And we have to keep doing this work because the more we have people who are getting the downstream effects of what these little canaries, these beautiful little canaries are showing us, the more we're going to need it. And the unfortunate thing is right now it feels like the education and the loudspeaker is only being held to the people who are the most exhausted and like downtrodden from the conditions that they have had to battle that there just aren't other answers for.
I think you're totally right. I mean, it's a weird, a sort of split personality because the scientist in me, of course, loves research because I want to know the answers and I want to know things. And I feel like we have to do it. It's like a duty in a way. If someone's using medicines, we need to test them. On the other hand, I am fully aware that if all the opinion polls you do, which people have done these focus groups and so on, patients don't care about evidence. They don't care, literally. If they have a condition, they've tried everything that conventional medicine has to offer, it doesn't work for them. They're suffering. They just want something that will work. You say to them, well, I've treated it before and they got better. I don't know if I can help you, but it's worth a try. They want to try it. And I feel very strongly that you should never take homeopathy away from someone who wants to use it. It should be made available to people who want to use it today. All these big questions, let's carry on trying to answer them, but you should not wait for those answers. We can't. People need help now.
So speaking of the conventional realm of care, there are a lot of people who will say that one of the biggest issues with homeopathy, they'll say, okay, fine, it's safe, fine, but it's delaying people getting appropriate care. So you might not get harm from the medicines themselves, but you will get harm by people not getting the actual care that they need. So I'm curious if this bears out in the research.
So the first thing actually is I can tell you it doesn't bear out in real life. From my 12 years in practice, every single person who came to me had already been to their doctor, repeat, that exhausted that avenue. And they were still seen by their doctor and I ensured they were. You know what I mean? There is that tandem care. So that's the reality. And in the research, we just don't see it. So it does frustrate me that that's a huge claim to make. And I've never seen any evidence that it's actually true. Nobody's ever been able to show that. We have 12 safety studies that are on our website. You just put safety into our search box and you'll find them. 11 out of the 12 said it's a low risk intervention. We're safe. And that's including this kind of safety aspect. The one that didn't find so favorably was co-authored by somebody called Edzard Ernst. So you can draw some conclusions. If you've heard his name, he's been an anti-homeopathy campaigner for many years. So whether that influenced that one out of 12, we can't say, obviously. But no, it's not what you see. There is one study done in France, we call it the EPI3, which is a massive study, 8,500 patients treated by 825 general practitioner doctors. So it's the biggest, you call that an epidemiological study, really looking at real world care. And they looked specifically at that, and there was no delay to treatment. There was no loss of therapeutic opportunity, as they called it. Everybody got appropriate care. And interestingly, what they saw was that the patients treated by doctors who were trained in homeopathy got the same or similar clinical outcomes to those treated with conventional medicines alone, but they used far fewer pharmaceutical drugs. So similar results, fewer drugs. I mean, you'd think that would be popular.
Right. Unless you own a drug company.
Exactly. And actually, crucially in that one, so the safety element was built into that. We didn't see any problem people getting real treatment. But the drugs where they saw that the use decreased when you're seeing a homeopath, they were crucial ones as well. This was not minor. Because they were looking at upper respiratory tract infections, musculoskeletal disorders, sleep, anxiety, and depressive disorders. You imagine all the drugs. So this was reductions in anti-inflammatories, painkillers, benzodiazepines, psychotropics, antibiotics, like all the biggies that everybody wants us to use less drugs. That's what happened in that major study.
So we want everybody to use less drugs, but we don't want them to use the thing that can help them use less drugs.
That's cheap and safe and easy to get. You know, it's like it's it, yeah, it's kind of strange, right?
All right, so I'm gonna walk us down to a path that maybe not everybody who listens to us is like as familiar with as you and I might be. I don't even know if Jody is familiar with this. She might just be looking at me sideways, going, "What are you even talking about?" But it because we're here to talk about research, and it comes up so frequently with people who are providing what they believe is to be like the strongest evidence against homeopathy of out there. So we call it just we refer to it in the homeopathic community as the Australian report. So this was it 2012, 2013,
2015.
2015. Okay, 2015 that this report came out. You are far more ensconced in the work related to this than I am. I just remember this report coming out and what a devastating blow it felt like it might be to homeopathy and what it was specifically in Australia to homeopathy. So can you tell us a little bit about this report just for people who don't even know what the heck I'm talking about? And then
Sure.
also tell us about the work that you guys have done related to this, because it's just a really problematic review.
No, it was traumatic to read because I could not believe what I was reading when this landed on my desk in 2015. I remember exactly the moment I read it. So this was a report written by the Australian government's own kind of research institutes. It's NHMRC, the National Health and Medical Research Council. It's a lot to remember. But basically, you just have to know it's an Australian government research institute, so it's a heavyweight. And they produced this report that said they'd looked at all the clinical evidence and they reached this conclusion saying there was no reliable evidence homeopathy worked for any of the 61 conditions they looked at. Obviously, for a lot of people, they're going, oh, well, that means it doesn't work. So this is what went around the world. Headlines literally all over the world. And as you said, to this day, this study, never mind that it's 10 years old, still gets quoted. So we obviously looked at this and I thought, how can you say that when I know the data? It's my job to know the data. And all those trials I mentioned, lots of those are pre-2015. So they were there, they existed. Then you realize keyword is reliable. They said there's no reliable evidence. So as soon as you see that, all the alarm bells go off, right? So what's reliable? And they made up a rule. They literally made it up. They said for a trial to be reliable, it has to have a minimum of 150 people in it, and it has to have a perfect quality score, 5 out of 5 on this scale that was used at the time, or equivalent on lots of different quality scales, basically perfect quality. So if you do that, it's not a surprise as to what happened. So they found 176 clinical trials. When you apply those rules, only 5 of those studies met their definition of a reliable study. So, funnily enough, you reduced the data down to 5 studies, which happened to be negative ones. There's no evidence. So, it was literally what they did, which is kind of insane. But the reason it wasn't kind of thrown in the waste paper bin immediately was, first of all, because the people who wrote it, you know, this has gravitas. And secondly, because they didn't make it obvious. You know, if they produced a study with only 5 studies in it, a report with 5 studies, you know, if they'd done it really transparently, everybody would have seen what really went on. But they basically hid it. They hid it in this huge report with 300 pages plus 300 pages of appendices. It was like the whole thing was very much hidden. So HRI worked with the Australian Homeopathic Association to basically almost take them to court. We did an ombudsman challenge, and this is the reason this was possible is because that report was paid for by taxpayers' money. So as soon as it's the taxpayer paying for it, you have a sort of right of reply as the public. So Gerry Dendrinos led that effort in Australia, basically went to the ombudsman and said, "This is not okay. This is misleading. This is false information. This is scientific misconduct." We were told by the lawyer it would take a year, maximum a year and a half. You know, when you're like, okay, do we really do this? Do we really take on the Australian government? I thought we have to. This is just not okay. 7 years that case went
No.
for.
Oh,
Seven
still, yeah, it
years.
was the
7 years. So, yeah, we fought that for 7 years. It went through rounds and rounds and rounds of investigation. It suddenly closed 2 years ago. I remember August 2023. They very suddenly said, oh, actually, we couldn't find an expert scientist to pass judgment on the evidence, like our evidence, basically, of saying why the science was not okay. And of course, the researchers would have countered that, you know, said there'd be their answers. And they could not get a suitably qualified independent expert to call it, to basically look at the evidence and say whether it was right or wrong. And lots of people in our community have said, oh, that's ridiculous, that's rubbish, it's bullshit, right? They must have been able to. And I said, no, I'm not actually surprised. Partly because we were involved in putting names forward. We put about 12 names. I think the other side put about 12 names. You know, we were part of that. I absolutely understand. Nobody wanted to touch this, right? Who wants to be the person from outside the homeopathy sector who's going to go on record and say the Australian government cooked the books? Right. It's an impossible ask. So I absolutely believe they couldn't get a suitable expert with no conflict of interest who was willing to do this. But of course, frustrating after 7 years where they basically said, so we couldn't decide on the science. You know, they wrapped their knuckles on a few procedural issues, but at the end of the day, it was basically a non-verdict after 7 years. So of course, a lot of people said to me, if you could go back and you'd known that, would you have done it? Because it's 7 years of my life I'm never going to get back. And I thought, I don't know. I'm glad I didn't know that. But I absolutely now believe it was the right thing to do because I think if we hadn't, it was setting a precedent. They were so cocky, you know, to do this blatant making up rules. Like, I just had to say, enough is enough. So I felt like we'd seen a lot of the homeopathy evidence not being treated fairly. We've seen that for years, but this was another level. This felt like trying to put the nail in the coffin of homeopathy, you know, and not doing it fairly, not doing it by the book. So I felt I will never regret doing it. I felt like we had to take a stand and we had to call them on it, and we did.
Was there anything done to acknowledge that they weren't able to validate it, basically?
Nope. Oh, the only thing that did come through this, which is, it's not small, along the way during the 7 years, there were two sort of positives that came from the whole effort, which were very clear. So the first is that in 2019, so this is 4 years later, the CEO of that research institute went on the record publicly and made a statement saying, contrary to claims made in the media, we never said homeopathy doesn't work. She actually put that on the record. We never said it was ineffective. So that is a quote. It's on our website. On our homepage, you can see an Australian button. You click there, you can see that quote by Anne Kelso, CEO of NHMRC. She went on record and said it. So if anyone today holds that up and says, the science says homeopathy doesn't work, wrong. CEO says so herself. So we forced that. And the second thing was that we uncovered, it's a royal we, this was not me, this was Gerry in Australia. When we did all the investigations to put the case together, he did a load of freedom of information requests. He bombarded them. He was like, you know, he really went for it like a terrier. And I'll never forget the day he rang up and said, Rachel, they did it twice. I was like, what? What? He said, there's another report. I was like, what are you talking about? There's another Australian report. They buried it. They hid it. I was like, what? And yeah, we found the first report done in 2012. By Professor Karen Grimmer, University of South Australia, really experienced researcher, professor, done loads of work for this organisation before. She got as far as an advanced draft report. What she found was encouraging, this is the quote, encouraging evidence for the effectiveness of homeopathy in five medical conditions. They killed it, they buried it.
Oh,
And they
wow.
did it all again. And then they published the 2015 version that said there was nothing. We're like, whoa, 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 can't do that. You cannot do that. So that was huge. I remember that day going, you are kidding me. They did it twice. So yeah, so we got and we forced that to be released. We did a campaign. And if anyone ever says to me, it's not worth signing a petition, if anyone ever says, I'm not going to respond to this call to action when people ask you, we got that report. It's in my desk drawer right here. So I mean, to be honest, we didn't think we would. We did a whole campaign, released the first report. We went all over the world saying, people, sign this, sign this, sign this. And we got it. So, you know, it shows you can do it. So I think, yeah, it gave me hope that sometimes you have to fight back, sometimes you have to stand up.
Well, the homeopathy community who understands and values the magic of a small dose of something should, can definitely understand the magic of a small group of people and the power that can really come from the right small actions, the right small things.
So, and I think just looking more positively into the future, yes, that 2015 report is still there. We're not, you know, we couldn't get it taken down because they couldn't pass judgment on the science. So, in a way, they've got away with it in that sense. But I think it was a big signal to the research world saying, hang on, we're looking now. Like, you thought we weren't going to notice. We noticed. Everybody noticed. I think Jerry even got questions raised in the Senate in Australia at one point, and it got through the Department of Health saying, we know what happened. Like everybody knows what happened. It's kind of one of those, like it's part of history now. Let's move on. Do you know what I mean?
It's just so infuriating that they're like, well, we can't validate the science, so we're going to leave it up as if it stands, instead of saying, like, we can't validate the science, so it's got to go down. Like, so we can't say that it's bad, but we also can't say that it's good.
Absolutely. And I think it's just that, you know, we have an expression here, buyer beware, right? Like when you buy something, you don't know what you're getting. It's like I always think with the science. Science is political, unfortunately. Research is political. You cannot separate the two. It's probably where I've ended up working most is this where science, politics, media, communications all meet. It's a very, very difficult area to navigate. And definitely a lot of what HRI tries to do is just unravel that and pull things out and say, look, this is a good study. That's rubbish. If we don't think a study is good, it doesn't go on our website if it's a homeopathy study. You know, there's far fewer pieces of evidence on our site than other people's for that reason, because we're only interested in the good stuff. So we pride ourselves on trying to curate the evidence base, point the sector and the public and other researchers. If it's on our site, it's decent. Not to say it's perfect, nothing is, but if it's on our site, you can trust it. So I feel like, especially with the internet, especially with AI, this is one of the most important things we do, trying to give people science they can trust.
What resources would you give people who can show their families or other medical providers who are skeptical about homeopathy?
I would absolutely say go to the HRI website. I wrote an evidence summary in December last year, which you can get from the homepage. So on our homepage, top left, you've got the sign up to the mailing list, which is how we can send you the new good studies every 3 months. But just below that, you'll see HRI evidence summary as a button. If you just click on that, you get actually, I had to bring this because I spent ages writing this, so now I want people to read it. So it's just a six-page PDF, and in fact, page of that is references. So I think, yeah, it's about 5.5 to 6 pages of actual information. And then for people who don't care, you can ignore the references at the back, but for scientists, you have to have those. So that's basically 5 to 6 pages was the shortest I could do, including some pictures and boxes, to talk about all of it. It's just snapshots. It's got the physicochemistry, you know, all the lab stuff. It's got some plant stuff. It's got the clinical data. It talks about where the research is going on in the world. So it's basically the idea I tried to do was one document that shows people there really is a homeopathy research world. We are a sector, and this is what we've got so far, and it's real. If it's not a printout thing you want, obviously it's a PDF, but that's also designed to print out. The other thing people can look at is the homeopathy FAQs. That's a great big button on our homepage. If you go there, that's what those are written for. The common things. What evidence is there? Is it safe? Is it cost effective? Do people, is it pseudoscience or not? All these kind of big things, even a bit about like cures like and mechanism of action. So, yeah, FAQs, evidence summary. Hopefully, those will work for people.
Yeah, I really, really appreciated the FAQs. I went years ago and I do not have the ability to understand research or even really read it, but I was like, oh, I can do FAQs. So I
Very
did the
simple.
FAQs and they were very helpful. So
Great.
for a mom that's dealing with a kiddo that's really ill and doesn't have the time to really
Yeah,
dig
we need
into the,
short, sweet, and
yeah, the research. So what can our listeners do to help support getting more research done? And how can they help get quality research into more healthcare providers' hands?
I really would say to people the best way, really, HRI is, the main moving entity worldwide, really trying to push this forward. So anything people can do to support us, and this isn't about asking for money, this is mostly these days about amplifying messages. You know how the world works. We know we're up against this massive wall of people who are skeptical and the powers that be who don't, for some reason, really want to pursue this topic. So we have to break through that. HRI is investing more and more. In fact, we've just taken on a new communications assistant so that next year we're really going to increase our social media presence. We've always been there, but we know we want to do more, reach new demographics, and so on. So I would ask anyone who's into that to please amplify what we put out. If we do do a call for action, if we could know that people are there to back us up, that really encourages us to keep going and helps us get our message out there. So it's really, again, getting our resources that we create for people to use out to people who need to hear them, whether that's a skeptical mum in the playground or a scientist in a government research institute. All of the information we put out there is trying to get to people who need it. So anything you can do to help us with that would be fantastic.
Well, Rachel, we are so grateful, as we said at the beginning, for your time and all of our persistence in making sure that this conversation was able to happen. I have to tell you that we host a Facebook group for community of families around the world who are learning about homeopathy for pans and pandas, and we're around, I think right now, as of this recording, about 27 to 28,000 people who are in the group. And I will tell you that every couple of months, I get a what do I share for my husband? What do I share for my primary care doctor? What do I share to my kid who's doing all the research? And HRI is the first place I go, and I mention
Oh,
it
fabulous.
all
That's
the
really good to
time.
hear.
And we have like we mention the work that you guys do every single chance that something comes up. If somebody
Thank you
says there's
so
no
much.
research, just okay, just go look at HRI. They're doing the work. I can't find it for you. Just go there. That's the place that you're going to find the information that you need.
That's great to hear. Thank you so much. Yeah.
So we're so happy that we're actually able to talk to you so people can understand the validity behind the work that you do, the rigor behind the work that you guys are doing, and just like some of the really fascinating things that you're collating and bringing together with the world of homeopathy research. So I am very grateful for your time and I'm grateful
Thanks
for
for
the
having
work
me,
that you're
both of you.
doing. Great. So we'll make sure we put links to everything in the show notes too, so it's easy for anybody to find, so we can help do our part to spread the word. So,
Thank
yes.
you. Yeah, it always has to be easy, doesn't it? For all of us, we're all busy.
Yes.
So.
And I just want to give you a great big thank you so much from all of the moms and dads, caregivers that will be watching this. I can tell that you're really passionate and you truly love what you do. You're excited about it. You just have like an energy about it. So I really appreciate you coming and sharing with us and letting us borrow some of your confidence in the work that you do because we don't have time to research. So your knowledge, information, and willingness to share it is a gift to the community that we work with.
That's
So
really
much
appreciated.
appreciated.
Thank you.
All right. Take care, everybody.
Take care.
We hope you found this episode helpful, hopeful, and inspiring. We would love to connect with you on social media and have you as part of our amazing community. You can find us on Facebook by searching for Homeopathy for Pans and Pandas.
If Facebook isn't your thing, you can also connect with us on Instagram and YouTube by searching for Resilience Naturopathic or clicking the links in our show notes. You can also visit our website, resiliencenaturopathic.com.
As always, we value your partnership in advocacy and education. Your support through following, sharing, rating, and reviewing our podcast is crucial in our mission to teach the world about PANS, PANDAS, and homeopathy. So if you found this podcast helpful, please leave us a review. Together, we are making a difference.
And finally, this podcast really is for you. Your questions and feedback help us make sure we are answering the right questions so you can feel confident making the next right step for your kids. Send us your questions or request guests by emailing us at podcast@resiliencenaturopathic.com, also linked in the show notes.